When someone holds power over us, the human spirit's instinct is to rise, resist, and rebel. As a construct, it feels wrong. In the wider geopolitical context, it can mean death and despotism. The way daring leaders combat power over is by using power with, power to, and power within. In their publication, Making Change Happen, Power, Jess Associates, a global interdisciplinary network of activists, organizers, educators, and scholars, defines three variations of power within the context of social justice and activism. They are equally helpful in organizations as they present pathways where team members can maintain their own agency and recognize their own sources of power in a way that ladders up to the greatest good. In our culture, we often talk about empowering people, but it's a nebulous concept that's difficult to define. What does that actually mean? I think these three elements make clear the work we need to do. Power with has to do with finding common ground among different interests in order to build collective strength, based on mutual support, solidarity, collaboration, and recognition, and respect for differences. Power with multiplies individual talents, knowledge, and resources to make a larger impact. Power to translates to giving everyone on your team agency and acknowledging their unique potential. It is based on the belief that each individual has the power to make a difference, which can be multiplied by new skills, knowledge, awareness, and competence. Power within is defined by the ability to recognize differences and respect others, grounded in a strong foundation of self-worth and self-knowledge. When we operate from a place of power within, we feel comfortable challenging assumptions and long-held beliefs, pushing against the status quo, and asking if there aren't other ways to achieve the highest common good. This next pairing in our armory is an important one. It's number 9 on our list, and the armored leadership is hustling for our worth. Daring leadership is knowing our value. When people don't understand where they're strong and where they deliver value for the organization or even for a single effort, they hustle. And not the good kind of hustle, the kind that's hard to be around because we're jumping in everywhere, including where we're not strong or not needed, to prove we deserve a seat at the table. When we do not understand our value, we often exaggerate our importance in ways that are not helpful, and we consciously or unconsciously seek attention and validation of importance. We put more value on being right than on getting it right. It creates franticness instead of calm cooperation. In daring leadership, rather than hustling for our worth, we know our value. Daring leaders sit down with their team members and have real rumbles with them about the unique contributions they make so that everyone knows where they're strong. Remember, too, that sometimes we overlook our own strengths because we take them for granted and forget that they're special. I'm a strong storyteller, the provenance of my upbringing. I sometimes forget that I'm uniquely equipped to do this because it's easy for me. Tuck your team members in around the areas where they quickly achieve flow. Those are typically where they are particularly primed to contribute value. As Kim Blanchard, the author of the 1982 best-selling leadership guide, The 1 Minute Manager, explains, catch people doing things right, because it's much more powerful than collecting behaviors that are wrong. Getting clear on our value and our team members' value will revolutionize our company and create lanes where none might have existed before. Instead of a 10-person race, we start to develop a coordinated relay in which team members baton toss to each other's strengths instead of vying to run the whole stretch alone. Once everyone understands their value, we stop hustling for worthiness and lean into our gifts. So number 10 on our list of armored leadership versus daring leadership is leading for compliance and control versus cultivating commitment and shared purpose. It's important to note that the compliance we're talking about is not legal, safety, or privacy compliance, or organizational compliance like vetting partners, wearing a hairnet, setting the alarm code on your way out, or putting in a vacation request with 2 weeks advance notice. The armor of compliance and control is normally about fear and power. When we come from this place, we often engage in two armored behaviors. First, we reduce work down to tasks and to-dos then spend our time ensuring that people are doing exactly what we want, how we want it, and then constantly calling them out when they're doing it wrong. The armor of compliance and control leads us to strip work of its nuance, its context, and larger purpose, then push it down for task completion, all while using the fear of getting caught as motivation. Not only is this ineffective, it shuts down creative problem solving, the sharing of ideas, and the foundation of vulnerability. It also leaves people miserable, questioning their abilities and even desperate to leave. The less people understand how their hard work adds value to bigger goals, the less engaged they are. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of failure and frustration. The second armored behavior is that when we operate from compliance and control, we also have a tendency to hold on to power and authority and push only responsibility down. This leads to huge alignment issues for people. They've been asked to do something that they don't actually have the authority to accomplish. They're not set up for success, so they fail. This just reinforces our power and resentment loop. I knew I should have done it myself. I'll be responsible for this. You just do the small tasks that you can handle versus let's dig into how we could have set you up for success. I know I have a part. The daring leadership fix to leading for compliance and control is cultivating commitment and shared purpose. Daring leaders, even in compliance-driven and highly structured industries like banking, healthcare, and the food industry, create and share context and color. They take the time to explain the why behind strategies and how tasks link to ongoing priorities and mission work. Rather than handing down black and white mandates stripped of story, they hold themselves responsible for adding texture and meaning to work and tying smaller tasks to the larger purpose. We used to utilize the DRI model. It's a model that came out of Apple, where you appoint someone as the directly responsible individual for a specific task. In our organization, we would record their duty in the meeting minutes. But what we learned is that despite the team members' willingness to own it and be held accountable for executing, they didn't always have the authority to be successful. So we've switched, and we're in the process of switching actually right now, from the DRI, the directly responsible individual model, to a task model, a task approach. We use TASC, which is an accountability and success checklist. So T, who owns the task? A, do they have the authority to be held accountable? S, do we agree that they're set up for success? Do they have the time, the resources, the clarity of mission? And C, do we have a checklist of what needs to happen to accomplish the task? So I know when you're listening to a book sometimes and these things are kind of spelled out, it can be a little confusing. So I'm going to go through it one more time. The task approach is really about who's accountable for something and have we given them everything they need to be successful? So T, who owns the task? A, do they have the authority to be held accountable? Meaning, are we asking them to do something that they actually have the authority to pull off? S, do we agree that they're set up for success in terms of time, resources, and clarity? And again, C, have we put together a checklist of what needs to happen to accomplish the task? We also, on top of this, borrowed the Scrum technique of what does done look like when assigning tasks, responsibilities, and deliverables. It was a huge improvement for us, but we needed to tweak it because it didn't address the need for tying deliverables to our purpose. For example, I'm out of town with my colleagues, Murdoch and Barrett, facilitating a daring leadership workshop. I asked them to collect one role play scenario from everyone participating in our 2-day training while I'm meeting with the CEO. I want to use these scenarios the next day. Later that evening, they slide a folder stuffed with handwritten scenarios under my hotel door. I wake up the next morning and panic. Now I have to sort through them and type them up. I'm frustrated with Murdoch and Barrett, and they have no idea why. The next time, I ask for the same thing, but Murdoch replies with, sure, what does done look like? I say, okay, please type them up, and you and Barrett should pick 3 that are specific enough to be meaningful, but general enough to apply across the group. It would be helpful if I could get them before 8 o'clock tonight so I can review them. Huge improvement. Huge improvement by asking what does done look like. But wait, Same scenario, but instead of saying, sure, what does done look like? Murdoch says, sure, let's paint done. Rather than slinging directives West Wing walk and talk style, we find Barrett and we talk for 5 minutes. I say, here's my plan. I want to collect scenarios from the participants today so we have new role plays for the group tomorrow. I don't want to reuse the ones we brought and use today. They're really struggling with these hard conversations, and the more specific the scenarios are to their issues and culture, the more helpful the role plays will be. My plan is to have you collect them and sort through them tonight, looking for ones that are specific but have broad appeal. I'd like y'all to type up 3 of them and make copies. Instead of breaking the group into pairs, I want to do triads with one person observing and supporting. So if we have 3 role plays for each group, they can each take a turn. Murdoch and Barrett think about it for a minute. Then Barrett says, you know, one issue is that everyone here today is from operations. Tomorrow is the marketing team. Will that affect the relatability of the role plays? That's when I say, damn it, it totally changes what I'm thinking. Thank you. This idea of paint done, for us, is significantly more helpful than what does done look like. Because it unearths stealth expectations and unsaid intentions and gives people who are charged with the task tons of color and context. It fosters curiosity, learning, collaboration, reality checking, and ultimately success. And here's what I want to say about that, because that scenario is a real scenario. The conversation of painting done took 5 minutes, y'all, and saved huge amounts of frustration. Let me give you one more scenario. I'm just going to talk this out just in a conversation, because that's what we're used to at work, right? Ben, hey, Brene, please pull all the invoices together for me by 4 o'clock. Me, sure, okay. 2 hours later, here you go, Ben. Ben says, what is this? I say, it's your invoices. Ben said, Brene, I needed them back to 2005 and in date order. Now I'm not going to be ready for my meeting with my boss. Then I will come back and say, how was I supposed to know that? So now Ben and I are super frustrated. We're frustrated with the process. We're frustrated with each other. Let's add paint done and task. Let's put those into operation and see how different this could be. Ben says, hey, Brene, please pull all the invoices together for me by 4 o'clock. I come back and say, okay, paint done for me. Ben, pull everything back to 2005 and put them in date order. I come back and say, what's the whole picture? Is that the whole picture? Ben says, yeah, I need to track the expenses for 2 books. When I hear that, I respond, wait, I don't understand. We didn't track expenses on invoices before 2007. You'll need separate receipts. Ben's like, oh man, I didn't realize that. Can you get those too? I come back and say, I can, but not by 4. What specifically do you need for your meeting? Paint done for me. Ben says, well, I'm trying to make the point that the shift in how we format our invoices actually changed expense categorizations. Okay, I respond, I don't think you'll need to pull everything. There's a better way to do that, and I can get that done and put it in a graph for you by 4. Ben, wow, thanks so much. That would be awesome. What support do you need from me to get this done? Is there anything that you can think of that's going to get in your way? Well, I say, I'll need to clear my plate for the next 2 hours. Ben, I'll take care of that. You jump on this. Brene, you got it. Ben, super grateful. I really appreciate it. So let's look at this conversation that just happened and see how the task, the accountability and success checklist, helped. The task, I own it. Accountability, Ben has given me the necessary authority to be held accountable. Success, our conversation ensured that I'm set up for success in terms of my time, resources, and clarity. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? And then checklist. Check. We did it together. We want people to share our commitment to purpose and mission, not to comply because they're afraid not to. That's exhausting and unsustainable for everyone. Leaders who work from compliance constantly feel disappointed and resentful, and their teams feel scrutinized. Compliance leadership also kills trust. And ironically, it can increase people's tendencies to test what they can get away with. We want people to police themselves and to deliver above and beyond expectations. painting done and using a task approach cultivates commitment and contribution, giving team members the space and the trust to stretch and learn, and allowing joy and creativity to be found even in the smallest of tasks. Number 11, armored leadership is weaponizing fear and uncertainty. Daring leadership is acknowledging, naming, and normalizing collective fear and uncertainty. In times of uncertainty, it's common for leaders to leverage fear and then weaponize it to their advantage. Unfortunately, it's been an easy formula throughout history, in politics, religion, and business, that if you can keep people afraid and give them an enemy who is responsible for their fear, you can get people to do just about anything. This is the playbook for authoritarian leaders here and around the globe. In the short term, it's relatively easy for leaders to stir up scarcity and promise to deliver more certainty with easy answers and a common enemy to blame. But in the face of complex problems, that certainty is quite literally impossible to fulfill. Daring and ethical leaders fight against this brand of leadership. What daring leadership is instead is acknowledging, naming, and normalizing collective fear and uncertainty. In the midst of uncertainty and fear, leaders have an ethical responsibility to hold their people in discomfort, to acknowledge the tumult, but not fan it, to share information and not inflate or fake it. Daring leaders acknowledge, name, and normalize discord and difference without fueling divisiveness or benefiting from it. When we're managing during a time of scarcity or deep uncertainty, it is imperative that we embrace the uncertainty. We need to tell our teams that we will share as much as we're able when we're able. We need to be available to fact check the stories that our team members might be making up, because in scarcity, we invent worst case scenarios. We need to open up the room for rumbling around vulnerability. There is incredible relief and power in naming and normalizing fear and uncertainty. We have to find the courage to look back at the people who are looking at us for leadership and say, this is difficult. There are no simple answers. There is pain and fear that would be very easy to unload on others, but that would be unfair and out of our integrity. We will walk through this in a way that makes us feel proud. It will be hard, but we'll do it together. Moving to number 12 in the armory, armored leadership is rewarding exhaustion as a status symbol and attaching productivity to people's self-worth. Daring leadership is modeling and supporting rest, play, and recovery. I wrote about this armor in my 2010 book, The Gifts of Imperfection, at a time of cultural crisis around busyness and sleep deprivation. Things might be moderately better now. There's definitely a growing awareness that insufficient sleep contributes to diabetes, heart disease, depression, and even fatal accidents. But we still struggle as a society around pegging our self-worth to our net worth. When worthiness is a function of productivity, we lose the ability to pump the brakes. The idea of doing something that doesn't add to the bottom line provokes stress and anxiety. It feels completely contrary to what we believe we want to achieve in life. We convince ourselves that downtime, like playing with our kids, hanging out with our partners, napping, tooling around in the garage, or going for a run, is a waste of precious time. Why sleep when you can work? And aren't treadmill desks supposed to be a replacement for that long Sunday run? The daring leadership response to exhaustion and productivity as self-worth is modeling and supporting rest, play, and recovery. The work of Dr. Stuart Brown, a psychiatrist, clinical researcher, and founder of the National Institute for Play, would argue that this lack of downtime, this lack of play, has a deleterious effect on our output in the office. In our desperate search for joy in our lives, we miss the memo. If we want to live a life of meaning and contribution, we have to become intentional about cultivating sleep and play. We have to let go of exhaustion, busyness, and productivity as status symbols and measures of self-worth. We are impressing no one. What's more, according to Brown's research, play shapes our brain, fosters empathy, helps us navigate complex social groups, and is at the core of creativity and innovation. In some ways, It helps our overheated brain cool down. To weave this into office culture, leaders need to model appropriate boundaries by shutting off email at a reasonable time and focusing on themselves and their families. Do not celebrate people who work through the weekend, who brag that they were tethered to their computers over Christmas break. Ultimately, it's unsustainable behavior, and it has dangerous side effects, including burnout, depression, and anxiety. It also creates a culture of workaholic competitiveness that's detrimental for everyone. As Stuart Brown says, the opposite of play is not work. The opposite of play is depression. Number 13 on our list of armored leadership versus daring leadership is tolerating discrimination, echo chambers, and a fitting in culture versus cultivating a culture of belonging, inclusivity, and diverse perspectives. In my 2017 book, Braving the Wilderness, I shared this definition of true belonging. True belonging is the spiritual practice of believing in and belonging to yourself so deeply that you can share your most authentic self with the world and find sacredness in both being a part of something and standing alone in the wilderness. True belonging doesn't require you to change who you are. It requires you to be who you are. The greatest barrier to true belonging is fitting in or changing who we are so we can be accepted. When we create a culture of fitting in and seeking approval at work, we're not only stifling individuality, we're inhibiting people's sense of true belonging. People desperately want to be a part of something, and they want to experience profound connection with others. But they don't want to sacrifice their authenticity, freedom, or power to do it. In daring leadership, we work to cultivate a culture of belonging, inclusivity, and diverse perspectives. Because only when diverse perspectives are included, respected, and valued can we start to get a full picture of the world, who we serve, what they need, and how to successfully meet people where they are. Daring leaders fight for the inclusion of all people, opinions, and perspectives because that makes us all better and stronger. That means having the courage to acknowledge our own privilege and staying open to learning about our biases and blind spots. We also have to watch for favoritism, the development of cliques or in-out groups. I often do focus groups with employees, and about half the time, I hear people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and even 60s still talk about the cool kids at work or the popular table in the cafeteria. Sometimes the quality that defines the in-group is achievement or seniority, and sometimes it's identity. Daring leaders work to make sure people can be themselves and feel a sense of belonging. Previously mentioned daring leadership strategies that promote this sense of belonging include recognizing achievement, validating contribution, and developing a system that includes power with, power to, and power within. Also, knowing your value. Number 14 in our armory is collecting gold stars versus giving gold stars. It's natural to want to be recognized for our achievements. Early in our career, when we're an individual contributor, collecting gold stars is fine, particularly if it's driven by healthy striving rather than perfectionism. And it can, in fact, be essential for figuring out where we add the most value when we're still at a stage where we're trying to figure out where we're strong. But once we transition into a management or leadership role, winning medals and stockpiling ribbons is no longer the goal. And it can be counterproductive to effective leadership. So the daring leadership response to collecting gold stars is giving gold stars. It sounds counterintuitive, but what got us promoted in the first place and what made us indispensable to the organization can get in the way of good leadership skills. Rewarding others rather than seeking to be rewarded is the only way to continue to grow within an organization and to fully embody the mantle of daring leadership. In a daring leadership role, it's time to lift up our teams and help them shine. This is one of the most difficult hurdles of advancement, especially for those of us who are used to hustling. Or we don't know exactly where we contribute value once the areas where we contributed value before are delegated to those coming up behind us. For this reason, it is essential that leadership be one of the explicit priorities for anyone in a role with direct reports. It cannot be a tacked-on assumption or done in our spare time. Bill Gentry talks about the need to flip the script when we find ourselves in a new role as a leader. His book, Be the Boss Everyone Wants to Work For, A Guide for New Leaders, is smart, practical skill building for those of us who are reluctant to give up our star collecting. Number 15 in the armory is zigzagging and avoiding versus straight talking and taking action. When I was in third grade, we lived in New Orleans, and my parents took me and my brother fishing in a swamp. When we got there, the caretaker of the land said, "If a gator comes at you, run a zigzag pattern. They're quick, but they ain't good at making turns." Well, we were only there 5 minutes before a gator snapped off the end of my mom's fishing pole. Mercifully, it never tried to chase us. Had it, I assure you that we would have all been zigzagging back to the car like crazy. Zigzagging is a metaphor for the energy we spend trying to dodge the bullets of vulnerability, whether it's conflict, discomfort, confrontation, or the potential for shame, hurt, or criticism. I tend to zigzag in times of vulnerability. For example, when I need to make a difficult call. I'll write a script, then I'll convince myself that the following morning is definitely better. Then I'll draft an email because that would be clearly superior to a call. I run back and forth until I'm wiped out, and I still need to make the call. The daring leadership response to zigzagging and avoiding is talking straight and taking action. We all know that it saves a tremendous amount of time and mental capacity to just turn around and face whatever is at our heels head on. The other advantage of stepping into the discomfort? It's actually much less scary and intimidating to appraise the situation from a face-first position, rather than looking back over our shoulder while running. In those moments, we need to stop and breathe. Bring clarity and awareness to what we're trying to avoid. Then get clear about what needs to be done to step into vulnerability. When we find ourselves zigzagging, hiding out, pretending, avoiding, procrastinating, rationalizing, blaming, lying, we need to remind ourselves that running is a huge energy suck and probably way outside of our values. At some point, we have to turn toward vulnerability and make that call. A couple of years ago, I spoke at a global leadership event for Costco. I was sitting at a table in the front row watching their CEO, Craig Jelinek, take questions from Costco leaders. The questions were tough, and 90% of the time, Craig's answers were as tough or tougher. I've seen a lot of CEOs take unvetted questions, and more often than not, when the questions have hard answers, the leader zigzags like there's a gator in hot pursuit. You hear a lot of non-answers. You hear a lot of, "Great question, let me give that some thought," or, "Wow, good idea, someone write that down so we can do some discovery," or, "Well, that's one way to frame the question." But on this cold morning in Seattle, there was no zigzagging, just straight talk. Yes, we did make that decision, and here's why. No, we're not going this direction, and here's how we got to that decision. I started thinking, damn, I've got to get on stage after this open question and answer session, and these people are going to be bristly. When Craig was done, the audience leapt to their feet, clapping and cheering. I was shocked. I turned to the woman sitting next to me and said, "That was really hard. He did not give them the answers they were looking for. Why is everyone cheering?" She smiled and said, "At Costco, we clap for the truth. We love the truth because it's increasingly rare. So let me give you the truth here. In case you find yourself in the swamp, you should know that humans can easily outrun alligators, which reach a max speed of 10 miles an hour, and they have no endurance. But they do have teeth, lots of teeth." And finally, our last of the 16 armored leadership versus daring leadership findings, leading from hurt versus leading from heart. I've learned to live by the saying, you can never get enough of what you don't need. It's not easy, especially when it comes to, for me, BBC crime procedurals, chips and queso, and approval. One of the patterns that I've observed in working with leaders is that many people lead from a place of hurt and smallness, and they use their position of power to try to fill that self-worth gap. But we can't just fill a self-worth gap by leading and using power over people, because that's not exactly what we need. To put it in simple terms, we work our shit out on other people because we can never get enough of what it is that we're after, because we're not addressing the real problem. In general, it's fair to say that we're all working our stuff out on people all day long. But when you add the leadership power differential, it gets dangerous. Leading from hurt behaviors include feeling no value from our partner or our children, so we double down on being seen as important at work by taking credit for ideas that aren't ours, staying in comparison mode, and always knowing instead of learning. The most common driver of the hurt I've observed is from our first families. The first family stuff can look like seeking the approval and acceptance from colleagues that we never receive from our parents. Also, if our parents' professional failures and disappointments shaped our upbringing, we can spend our careers trying to undo that pain. That often takes the shape of an insatiable appetite for recognition and success, of unproductive competition, and, on occasion, of having zero tolerance for risk. Identifying the source of the pain that's driving how we lead and how we show up for other people is important, because returning to that place and doing that work is the only real fix. Projecting the pain onto others places it where it doesn't belong and leads to serious trust violations. Our long, hard search for whatever it is that we need never ends and leaves a wake of disconnection. The daring leadership response to leading from hurt is leading from heart. Let's go back to this sentence from section 2. Leaders must either invest a reasonable amount of time attending to fears and feelings, or squander an unreasonable amount of time trying to manage ineffective and unproductive behavior. Well, leader, heal thyself. We also have to invest time attending to our own fears, feelings, and history, or we'll find ourselves managing our own unproductive behaviors. As daring leaders, we have to stay curious about our own blind spots and how to pull those issues into view. And we need to commit to helping the people we serve find their blind spots in a way that's safe and supportive. Like all of us, most of the daring, transformational leaders I've worked with have overcome hurtful experiences, from childhood illness and painful family histories to violence and trauma. Many are in the middle of deep struggles, like marriages that are falling apart, children in rehab, or health crises. The difference between leading from hurt and leading from heart is not what you've experienced or are currently experiencing. It's what you do with your pain and hurt. One of the most powerful examples of leading from heart that I've witnessed was Tarana Burke's response to Harvey Weinstein's arrest. Tarana is the senior director at Girls for Gender Equity and founder of the Me Too movement, a movement to end sexual violence. In an interview with Trevor Noah, Tarana said, "This is not really a moment to, like, celebrate how the mighty have fallen." She explained that the focus should be on healing the survivors and recognizing their courage. In a world full of rage and hate, Tarana, who is a survivor of sexual assault and has dedicated her career to helping other survivors, said, "It doesn't bring me personal joy. This is not really what it is about," she explained. "It's not about taking down powerful men, and it's not a women's movement either. That's another sort of misconception. It's a movement for survivors." Foreshadowing the work we'll do together in the part on learning to rise, when we own our own hard stories and rumble with them, we can write a new ending, an ending that includes how we're going to use what we've survived to become more passionate and empathetic. When we deny our stories of struggle, they own us. They own us and they drive our behavior, emotions, thinking, and leading. Daring leadership is leading from heart, not hurt. Putting down the armor. Roosevelt's speech makes no mention of armory or weaponry. There are no shields glinting in the afternoon sun, no sabers, swords, or rifles. It would appear that the unarmored person in the arena is fighting with their wits, their bravery, and their bare hands. Roosevelt is talking about grappling, person to person. As long as I've studied vulnerability, which dates back to my dissertation research in 1998, I will always think that the very best example of vulnerability is saying I love you first. Talk about taking off the armor. Oof, just thinking about that moment takes my breath away. Like many of you, I've taken that risk and I've had the indescribable experience of hearing, oh my God, I love you too. And I've been on the shitty end of, oh, thank you. But I think we're on different pages. People, people, people. In those moments, it's hard to remember that the brokenhearted are the bravest among us because they got past their egos and busted their hearts out of that prison so they could love. Yes, there's pain. And more dust and sweat and blood. It's hard. And when we don't understand that the willingness to risk hurt or failure is courage, or we don't have the skills to rumble and recover, it's easy to reach for the armor and weapons at the mere whiff of vulnerability. As our work around the world has taught us, the fear of vulnerability and all that comes with taking off the armor, the fear of being judged or misunderstood, of making a mistake, being wrong, and experiencing shame is universal. The leaders interviewed for this book represent organizations across the globe, from film studios, tech companies, and accounting firms, to military commands, schools, and community building organizations. How is it possible that the fear of taking off armor is universal? People, people, people everywhere are just people, people, people. A couple of years ago, we held a training in London, and the participants came from more than 40 countries. As we waded into topics of vulnerability and shame, one of the participants stood up and said, "Our shared experiences of these emotions is so shocking. It's what we have in common more than anything else." The cultural messages and expectations that fuel feelings of vulnerability and even shame may be different, but the experiences themselves, as well as their ability to alter who we are and how we show up, are universal. One powerful universal truth that has stood the test of global research is this. If shame and blame is our management style, or if it's a pervasive cultural norm, we can't ask people to be vulnerable or brave. Shame can only rise to a certain level before people have to armor up and sometimes disengage to stay safe. Another learning about the universal applicability of daring leadership findings came from the people we interviewed who lead distributed global teams. They talked about the importance of having ongoing, difficult, and vulnerable conversations about the different cultural messages and expectations that corrode trust and psychological safety in a team when they're not identified and discussed. One participant, who's a champion of daring leadership in her company, leads a team of highly skilled analysts located all over the world who are diverse not only in terms of culture, but also of age and gender identity. She said, "One of the most important and most challenging parts of my job is surfacing what's getting in the way of our team's communication and performance. Last year, I noticed a pattern of our team in Hong Kong not participating in video conference meetings. They're major contributors, so I couldn't figure out why they were holding back. I reached out to them without our other colleagues on the line and said, 'We need to hear from you in these meetings. Not participating is not working. What can I do to support your participation?'" She told me there was a long pause before one man spoke up and said, "We've asked many times to receive the agenda in advance of the meetings. When we get the agenda 10 minutes before the meeting starts, it feels disrespectful. If you really wanted our contribution, you would give us time to review and prepare." She explained that this type of frank conversation was a norm. There are almost always conversations about cultural norms and differences. No one wants to talk about these issues because they're awkward and uncomfortable. But I know it's critically important, and it's my job as a leader to push through the discomfort. I love how she ended this interview with me. She said, "It's never easy, but we're always grateful and stronger when we're done." Section 4. Shame and empathy. Digging into shame. If you want to see the ego, go to DEFCON 1, get anywhere close to shame. What makes embracing vulnerability feel the most terrifying is how taking off the armor and exposing our hearts can open us up to experiencing shame. Our egos are willing to keep our hearts encased in armor no matter the cost, if we can avoid feeling less than or unworthy of love and belonging. What the ego doesn't understand is that stunting our emotional growth and shutting down our vulnerability doesn't protect us from shame, disconnection, and isolation. It guarantees them. Let's look at how shame works and why it can't survive a healthy dose of empathy. Shame, which is often referred to as the master emotion by researchers, is the never good enough emotion. It can stalk us over time or wash over us in a second. Either way, its power to make us feel like we're not worthy of connection, belonging, or even love is unmatched in the realm of emotion. If we lean into vulnerability and resist the urge to armor up, and that leads to our feeling blamed, put down, ignored, or pushed away, shame can deal such a painful blow to our sense of self-worth that just the fear of experiencing that can send us running from the vulnerability rumble. I've written extensively about shame in all of my books, so I've gathered the important pieces from other books to give you a primer here. But before we dissect shame, let me walk you through a recent example. In July 2017, 1 month after I delivered the final manuscript for Braving the Wilderness to my publisher, I was 3 weeks into my pre-book tour boot camp. The book before Braving the Wilderness was Rising Strong. And the week after that book tour ended, I had sworn to myself that I would never embark on another book tour without getting into physical, mental, and spiritual shape. The new book was set for release on September 12th. I love being on the road and spending time with our incredible, wholehearted community. It's truly one of the great unexpected gifts of my life. But if I'm not physically, mentally, and spiritually fit, the planes, hotels, and homesickness can crush me. Late-night room service becomes my best friend, my coping skills start to wear thin, and if I'm not careful, anxiety and loneliness can set in. The worst part of this is that when I'm not in fighting shape, I collapse when I get home. I can't get out of bed for 2 or 3 days, and my kids come to my room and visit me like I'm in the hospital. At first, I thought the problems were driven by my introversion. I'm a 10 on a 10-point scale of introversion. I require a significant amount of alone time to function on all cylinders. But we started testing new travel strategies, and I realized it's more than that. I've never been in a good place without working out and paying attention to my spiritual life. When I'm committed to these practices, it's magic. Well, magic, discipline, and a shit ton of hard work. But it's really, really solid. 3 weeks into running, working out, rocking my keto plan, practicing my centering prayer, shopping for cute outfits to wear on the road, and setting masterclass level boundaries for the tour, things looked pretty good. On the 10th of July, I drove 20 minutes from my house to Wire Road Studios in the Houston Heights to record the audiobook for Braving the Wilderness. I love this studio and do all of my recording work there. I remember bouncing into the front office that morning and passing my favorite photo of Beyonce hanging on the wall. I was in such a good mood, filled with possibility. I just wanted to give her photo a high five. H-Town girls bringing it. We were 10 minutes into the recording when the sound engineer's voice came over my headphones. "I can hear your earrings. Can you take those off, please?" I said, "Sure, sorry about that." I hustled out of the sound booth toward a bench in the hall where my purse was sitting, walking fast and looking down to put the earring backing into the hoop that I had just pulled off my ear. I plowed, forehead first, into a 6-inch-thick glass wall. I don't remember much after that, just waking up on the floor, and I remember the pain. I knocked myself unconscious for a full minute. And when I came to, I was completely confused. I was crying and people were helping me, but I was out of it. Karen, my audiobook producer, insisted that she should drive me home or to the doctor's office. But I wanted to go back to reading. We were on a super tight schedule. I read for 30 more minutes until I finally started crying again. I looked at Karen and said, I just can't. I don't know what's wrong. She offered to drive me home, but I assured her that I was fine. I drove to the office, but I don't remember a single minute of that drive. When I walked in, people gasped at the ping pong ball-sized lump protruding from my forehead. Again, I assured everyone I was fine. I jumped on a Zoom call with my team. I was sitting next to Barrett and Suzanne in our office. Murdoch and Chaz were beaming in from New York and Austin. Apparently, a few minutes into the call, I said, "I don't understand what's happening. I don't understand." Murdoch responded, "Brene, are you sure you're okay?" They tell me that my mood shifted and I snapped back. "Leave me alone. I'm just tired." Then I threw up in the trash can under Suzanne's desk, wiped the throw up off my chin, folded my arms on her desk, and went to sleep. I woke up at home. My team had called my husband and he had left his office to meet us at the house. He was asking me questions, and they tell me I was combative, frustrated, and crying. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't line up my thoughts or my vision. Steve kept asking me to look at him, but I remember it being so much work that it hurt. I could only look through him or past him. My sister was standing out of sight, scared and fighting back tears. I was diagnosed with a severe concussion, but as familiar as that sounds, I would quickly learn that I had no idea what that meant. The day after the injury, my team sprang into action. They started canceling upcoming speaking dates and shifting my calendar. I was pissed. I kept saying, "I'm going to be fine in a week. These are huge events with contracts that have been in place for over a year. There's no reason to cancel." Murdoch was clear. "You don't get a vote on this." I wouldn't relent. I couldn't. I was swallowed up by shame and fear. Researchers Tamara Ferguson, Heidi Ayer, and Michael Ashbaker have found that unwanted identity is one of the primary elicitors of shame. They explain that unwanted identities are characteristics that undermine our vision of our ideal selves. Sick, unreliable, and undependable are huge unwanted identities for me. As a fifth-generation German-American Texan, I grew up believing that illness is weakness. Not in other people. In other people, it's human and it's okay and we should support and help. But in our family, being sick is lazy. And if you're tough enough, you can walk off anything. Trust me when I tell you that no one who lives by this loves it. But the shame is so enveloping that it's hard to break free. Unlearning this belief has been one of the hardest and most painful lessons of my life, and a battle I have to constantly refight, given the culture's reinforcement of it. But I will continue to fight and talk about it because I do not want to pass this belief down to my children. It's a terrible way to live. 5 days after I hit my head, I couldn't function. I had a black eye down to my cheek and a huge bruised forehead. I couldn't read, watch TV, look at a computer screen, or be in bright light. It hurt to think. And the harder I tried to get back to normal, the worse it got. Every time I pushed, I regressed. I had wrestled away the shame self-talk about canceling the events with some self-compassion and empathy from my team. But now I was feeling shame about losing control of what I believed made me me, my mind. What about my plan to get stronger for the book tour? What if I don't get better? What if I don't heal? What if I've written my last book? What if I can never do research again? Finally, Trey, a dear friend of our family, sat down with me and shared his 19-year-old wisdom. He laid it all out and held nothing back. He told me hard things that I didn't want to hear, but he did it with such tenderness and empathy that I just listened and cried. He was a rugby player in high school and had suffered his first concussion 6 months earlier, playing as a freshman in college. He said, "I know this is scary, and you can't even describe it to other people, but it's real. And the harder you fight it, the worse it's going to get and the longer it's going to take to heal. You can't win this fight by being tough. You can't fight your way back. You need time. This is real, and it's scary when your mind stops working. You're going to have to find a way to let go for the next few weeks." After a month, I slowly started returning to work. Every time I pushed a little too hard, there was a setback. I still couldn't work out, but I could find my way to the pantry to comfort eat. I gained 10 pounds, just enough so that every outfit I bought for the tour no longer fit. Whatever good physical, mental, spiritual shape looked like, this was the opposite. The fear that I would never get back to my old self and that trying to come back was permanently damaging my brain turned into serious anxiety. I made an appointment to see the neuropsychologist who works with the Houston Texans and the Houston Rockets and specializes in concussion management. Steve and I went together, and it was beyond helpful. I learned that the anticipatory anxiety I was experiencing about the fear that I would never feel like myself again was normal, and she gave me some strategies to deal with it. I also got the okay to go back to work and do some light exercise, and she gave me some tips on how to listen to what my body needed. When I got home that day, I felt hopeful. I can do this. I've still got a little more than 2 weeks before the tour now, and I can start first thing tomorrow if this weather ever clears up. Hurricane Harvey hit Houston the next day. Our neighborhood was decimated. Team members lost their homes. It was heartbreaking. The book tour launched on time. We moved in the middle of the hurricane cleanup. More hard things happened. More beautiful things happened. And connecting with my community was a healing balm. Somehow, we all managed to love and lean on each other with so much empathy and kindness through those months that shame kept its distance. Mercifully, I haven't had another injury or illness as serious as that concussion. But I did wrestle down a virus over Christmas and nurse both of my kids through mono over the past year. I'm happy to report that while I've never used suck it up and push through with anyone but myself, they are no longer in my vocabulary at all. It took 50 years to let go of those shame messages, but better late than never. Let's start with shame 101. Because I always like to start with the shame 1-2-3s. One, we all have it. Shame is universal and one of the most primitive human emotions that we experience. The only people who don't experience shame are those who lack the capacity for empathy and human connection. So here's your choice. Fess up to experiencing shame or admit that you're a sociopath. Quick note, this is the only time that shame seems like a good option. Number two, we're all afraid to talk about shame. Just the word is uncomfortable. Three, the less we talk about shame, the more control it has over our lives. First, shame is the fear of disconnection. As we talked about in the myths of vulnerability, we are physically, emotionally, cognitively, and spiritually hardwired for connection, love, and belonging. Connection, along with love and belonging, is why we're here, and it's what gives purpose and meaning to our lives. Shame is the fear of disconnection. It's the fear that something we've done or failed to do, an ideal that we've not lived up to, or a goal that we've not accomplished, makes us unworthy of connection. Here's the definition of shame that emerged from my research. Shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we're flawed and therefore unworthy of love, belonging, and connection. Shame drives two tapes, never good enough, and who do you think you are? These gremlin-like voices work as a terrible vice. Right when you overcome the not good enough whisper and muster up the courage to enter the arena, the shame gremlins hit you with, wow, you think you have what it takes to pull this off? Good luck. The Texas gremlins would say, don't get too big for your britches, sister. Retreating into our smallness becomes the most seductive and easiest way to stay safe in the midst of the shame squeeze. But as we've talked about, when we armor and contort ourselves into smallness, things break and we suffocate. Here are some of the responses we received when we asked people for an example of shame. Shame is getting laid off when we're expecting our first child. Shame is hiding my addiction. Shame is raging at my kids. Shame was my response to seeing my parents shame when I came out. Shame is covering up a mistake at work and getting caught. Shame is watching things change so fast and no longer knowing how and where I can contribute. Shame is failing at my business after my friends invested in it. Shame is getting a promotion, then getting demoted 6 months later because I wasn't succeeding. Shame is my boss calling me a loser in front of our colleagues. Shame is not making partner. Shame is my wife asking me for a divorce and telling me that she wants children, but not with me. Shame is getting sexually harassed at work, but being too afraid to say anything because he's the guy everyone loves. Shame is constantly being asked to speak on behalf of all Latinos in marketing meetings. I'm from Kansas. I don't even speak Spanish. Shame is being proud of a completed project, then being told it wasn't at all what my boss wanted or expected. And then last, and certainly not least, because this is one of the greatest shame triggers at work, shame is watching things change so fast and no longer knowing how and where I can contribute. The fear of being irrelevant is a huge shame trigger we're not addressing at work. We may not be able to relate to the exact examples, but if we know ourselves and are in touch with our vulnerability, we can recognize that unbearable pain in other people's experiences. Shame is universal. Current neuroscience research shows us that the pain and feelings of rejection that shame inflicts are as real as physical pain. Emotions can hurt. And just as we have to describe, name, and talk about physical pain to heal it, we have to recognize and talk about shame to get out from underneath it. This is even more difficult than talking about physical pain because shame derives its power from being unspoken. That's why even the word shame is tough to say. Shame, guilt, humiliation, embarrassment. Another reason that shame is so difficult to talk about is the vocabulary. We often use the terms embarrassment, guilt, humiliation, and shame interchangeably, when in reality, these experiences are very different in terms of biology, biography, behavior, and self-talk, and they lead to radically different outcomes. Let's start with shame and guilt because these are the two we most often confuse, and the consequence of doing that is severe. The majority of shame researchers and clinicians agree that the difference between shame and guilt is best understood as the difference between I am bad and I did something bad. Guilt, I did something bad. Shame, I am bad. When I was trying to decide how much I wanted to share with my team about how fear and anxiety were the real drivers behind my unreasonable timelines, it was shame that was holding me back. As I said in the previous section, the gremlin message was, you research leadership and you can't even lead. You're a joke. It wasn't guilt. Guilt would be, man, I've been unfair to my team with these timelines. I've made the wrong choice for the wrong reasons. It was shame. It's not that I've made bad choices. I am a bad leader. In our political chaos, people throw around the word shameless when they see someone making a self-serving or unethical decision and attributing unconscionable behavior to a lack of shame. This is wrong and dangerous. Shame isn't the cure, it's the cause. Don't let what looks like a bloated ego and narcissism fool you into thinking there's a lack of shame. Shame and fear are almost always driving that unethical behavior. We're now seeing that shame often fuels narcissistic behavior. In fact, I define narcissism as the shame-based fear of being ordinary. Grandiosity and bluster are easy to assign to an overinflated ego. It's tough to get a glimpse of the fear and lack of self-worth that are actually behind the posturing and selfishness, because posturing leads to weaponizing hurt and turning it on other people. The last thing people like that need is more shame. More accountability for their behavior and lack of empathy? Yes. More shame just makes them more dangerous, gives them the opportunity to redirect attention to the shaming behavior, and weirdly, can drum up support from others who are also looking for a way to discharge their pain and an enemy to blame. Shame is not a compass for moral behavior. It's much more likely to drive destructive, hurtful, immoral, and self-aggrandizing behavior than it is to heal it. Why? Because where shame exists, empathy is almost always absent. That's what makes shame dangerous. The opposite of experiencing shame is experiencing empathy. The behavior that many of us find so egregious today is more about people being empathyless, not shameless. While shame is highly correlated with addiction, violence, aggression, depression, eating disorders, and bullying, guilt is negatively correlated with those outcomes. Empathy and values live in the contours of guilt, which is why guilt is a powerful and socially adaptive emotion. When we apologize for something we've done, make amends, or change a behavior that doesn't align with our values, guilt, not shame, is most often the driving force. We feel guilty when we hold up something we've done or failed to do against our values, and they don't match up. It's a psychologically uncomfortable feeling, but one that's helpful. The discomfort of cognitive dissonance is what drives meaningful change. Shame, however, corrodes the very part of us that believes that we can change and do better. Humiliation is another word that we often confuse with shame. Donald Klein captures the difference between shame and humiliation when he writes, "People believe they deserve their shame. They do not believe they deserve their humiliation." If Sonia is in a meeting with her colleagues and her principal calls her a failure because of her class test scores, Sonia will probably